And I'll ask our marshal to call our next case.
Calling case number A231730, Tal Sarusi versus Todd Laughlin.
Good morning. Go ahead and set up. I'll just make preliminary comments. Each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. The podium does have a device on the underside that'll move it up or down depending on your comfort level. And a final reminder to indicate your name and which client you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your remarks. I talked rather quickly. Appellant counsel, take your time. When you're ready, go ahead and approach the podium.
Thank you, Judge. We have a bit of a larger record, so I want to make sure that if you want to ask questions, I have it available for me. To begin?
Sure.
Good morning. May it please this court, opposing counsel. My name is Eric Hansen, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Tal Sarusi and Sealed Envelope LLC. This case presents a question to the court of what are the outer bounds of a permissible argument and when must a trial court intervene? Additionally, this case presents a clear example of a jury verdict not being supported by the evidence at trial. In fact, I believe that the argument will show that that jury verdict is so grossly disproportionate to the actual damages that it requires intervention by the court and can only have been arrived at as a result of prejudice. I think it's
so it strikes me before we get too far that argument about the unjust enrichment damages being so excessive that it requires, I mean, that seems to be more of an argument for a new trial, a remitter, than it is a JMOL argument.
Yeah. I mean, I think the appropriate response of the district court would have been remitter.
Right. So that's really the lens we're looking through. I mean, you acknowledge there was some evidence. I know it was disputed, but there was some evidence to support the claimed unjust enrichment damages the jury awarded. I mean, there's not a whole-scale failure of evidence.
There was
support.
Not no evidence, and I think in my brief I concede that using their chart of damages, and I think the lens that this court has to look at it through, is there any evidence at all that supports the jury verdict? I think that number is in the 70,000 range.
Right.
So I think the point of the excessive is we're way beyond what, even if you took everything as true, the $400,000 number that you get to, you just cannot get there unless you count things that you cannot recover for under unjust enrichment.
So the remedy would really be a new trial?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that that remedy is necessary in importantly because of the prejudicial remarks. And I think really the case that I believe talks about this in the most detail is the Hake versus Suline, cited in my brief, but it's a Supreme Court decision from 1977. And I think the important thing that I wanted to point out is, one, I think it's important to acknowledge, standing where I'm standing, this is an abuse of discretion standard. It's a high burden, respectfully, I think.
Are you on the unjust enrichment? Because it would be a de novo review as far as the JMOL request, right?
With regard to the JMOL, yes. Sorry, my transition wasn't clear there. I was going to talk about the prejudice and the prejudicial remarks in the argument, But I do think that those tie into our unjust enrichment.
All right, but as far as the supposed prejudicial remarks and not commenting one way or the other, if they were, you didn't object at trial when the trial was, are you talking about the argument of counsel?
Correct.
Was there an objection made at that time?
There was not. There was a...
The reason I ask that is because in some ways this could be construed as one of those aha moments when after the fact you think about it, you go back and you look at it, and that's pretty much the argument that respondent is raising. So how do we get around that? Because it is easy to go back and say, you know, maybe that remark was a little slanted or had had some dubious meaning.
Right. And so I'll address that directly. The answer to your question is I think that that Hake makes it clear that there are certain extraordinary circumstances where whether there's an objection or not, the district court has an obligation to step in. And I think that that is this case. And the other point that I was going to make about Hake is that if you read the Hake decision where they talk about there's this limited band of really bad comments where, nope, district court's got an obligation whether there's an objection or not. The very next thing the Hake court talks about is it talks about whether or not the damages award greatly exceed adequate compensation. And thus, and if so, you know, that the only way to account for the excessive award is prejudice. Well, I would argue that this case is the fact scenario that Hake is talking about, where you have a damages award that is so in excess of what it possibly could be under the law that the only way you account for that is prejudice. And it is that prejudice that the court had an obligation to step into and say, no, we're not going there. That is improper, and we will not allow it under fair play, frankly.
What's the import of the fact that even at the post-trial motion stage, when trial counsel raised the issue of or challenged sort of the theory, the language that was used by respondents' counsel during argument, but did not tie that language to any of the concerns you're expressing on appeal, really tied that tied the language to the district court's pretrial ruling that you're not going to suggest that your client was acting to evade tax responsibility and things like that. So how do we reconcile your argument that this is like Hake, that this was just so obvious that the court was required to do something, with the fact that not only did trial counsel not object in real time, but didn't even in post-trial motions make the argument of prejudice that you're making to this court?
I guess I would slightly disagree in your characterization in that it was raised in the JMOL motion, and you know some of the very problematic quotes about dismembering the baby was raised to the district court. Was it tied in the way that I am asking this court to tie it? It was not. I don't have an explanation for you other than I respectfully, I think trial counsel missed the ball. I have tried cases. I don't know how you sit there and say nothing when putting aside the whole religious aspects of it, referring to a spray foam company as a baby that's being killed is inappropriate, just baseline. So the idea that you wouldn't stand up and say something about it, I cannot explain. I don't agree with it. But I have the record that I have on appeal. However, I do believe very strongly that on these facts, given who these people were and given the repeated invocation of this, especially in the context of Mr. Cerussi being acknowledged Jewish, the money coming from his rabbi, the direct invocation of the killing of a child and then selling it for profit, I'm sorry, but I believe the district court just has an obligation to act, regardless of whether or not trial counsel's asleep at the wheel or not. There are some lines that our system imposes on our judicial officers to step in and say, that's a bridge too far. And this is a bridge too far, in my opinion. And I think that it is proven by the fact that we've got, even using, you know, the most generous numbers to them, you know, we've got a verdict that's five times what you could have possibly awarded.
Well, I mean, the verdict, you know, they asked that the damages evidence that was came in partially by the exhibit 236, I think it was.
Yeah, I believe 236. It is, yes.
I mean, it claims unjust enrichment damages of $860,000, and that was evidence in the case. Why should we conclude that the award that the jury ultimately entered of $448,000 is just so excessive that could only be explained by prejudice?
I think that that really goes to, is that evidence? And I would submit that it is not competent evidence. There were, and that table, 236, is a summary. And it summarizes a variety of different categories of damages. And there was, and this is cited in some detail in my brief, but there was a discussion by the trial, you know, with the trial court about what exhibits were coming in, and there were stipulations as to foundation.
But then it got admitted without, I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I understand it was premised with the court saying parties have stipulated to foundation, they agree. But then as they discuss the documents, it ends up that they are simply admitted. And the jury is told they're going to see these exhibits and they can publish them to the jury when they're... So, I mean, I understand your argument about there's a difference between stipulation to foundation and stipulation to admission of evidence, but this seems to be the latter, even if that wasn't the intent of the parties going in.
I guess I would disagree in that I believe the record's fairly clear that they are talking about foundation and foundation only. Should there have been a secondary objection with regard to these exhibits? Sure, but that's, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, and I understand that that's not the job of this panel. But when the conversations are had about the exhibits, it's very clear that the conversation is, we're talking about a stipulation as to foundation. I don't think that that can be construed as an acknowledgement that Mr. Cerussi is saying all of these damages are appropriate, because they're just not. There's entire categories in 236 that are not recoverable under any form of unjust enrichment. Give you a couple of quick examples. I mean,
once the exhibits are before the jury, isn't it within their prerogative to consider them?
Within the instructions that the court gives the jury, and I think that, you know, that should this have been clarified? Yes. Should it have been clarified by counsel? Yes. Is there an obligation on the part of the judicial officer to clarify? Yes. That's what we have judges for. They're referees, to say to jurors, this is the law, this is what you consider, this is what you can't consider.
The judge is not going to try the case for the lawyer.
Agreed.
I mean, you're putting a pretty high burden on the trial court to kind of figure out what the attorneys are thinking.
Again, I go back to being the referee. At the end of the day, it's the judge's job to instruct the jury.
But they don't play the game either. The judge is not going to get in the game. He's going to make sure that things are conducted properly, but he's not going to be a player in the game.
Right. I agree with that.
The criticism of a lot of trial court judges is that they start using an influence on the game. Or the trial.
Right, but I think that the district court does have an obligation that when you put things that you cannot collect on it, that it's important to instruct the jury.
Didn't the court actually give such an instruction, though, that said, kind of identified categories of things that could not be considered unjust enrichment?
And there was some discussion of that, and I respectfully submit that it didn't work.
Right, but you're not claiming on an appeal that the jury was improperly instructed.
No, I'm not. The on appeal, things I am challenging are the court's failure to intervene when repeatedly blood libel was invoked.
Tell me specifically what it is that you think the court should have done. What should it have instructed the jury?
I think that the district court should have said to the jury, unjust enrichment, given the unjust enrichment instructions, these categories are damages that you can award.
Wouldn't that be something the attorney can make in summation as far as arguing damages to the jury? That's what the lawyer does. The lawyer says, look, here's unjust enrichment. Pick A, B, C, and D and forget about E.
Sure, but the district court also says, listen to what I tell you, and my instructions are what you're supposed to follow. And that's part of our system. I think that there's a failure here as the gatekeeper. I think that the bigger failure is not intervening when this goes badly off the rails, either in saying we're not going to be referring to the spray foam company as a baby that's being dismembered, and two, we are not, that's where remitter lies. There is, our system has the ability to say, wow, this bears no resemblance to the actual evidence that I sat here and heard. That's what remitter does. The court didn't exercise that. I think that it's an error. I think that it's an abuse of discretion, and it requires a reversal and a new trial.
Thank you. We'll hear from respondent counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Gregory Martin Hansen on behalf of Todd Laughlin and LB Spray Foam LLC respondents. The trial court decision, quite frankly, should be affirmed. The jury and the judge got it right. There's no question that there were questions of fact regarding whether or not a contract was formed between the parties regarding the sale of LB Spray Foam, the alleged sale of LB Spray Foam. The jury heard the evidence on that and confirmed very succinctly with a no, there was no contract. The appellate court has to reconcile the special verdict answers with a reasonable manner consistent with the evidence and its fair inferences. The verdict should stand if the answers are reconciled under any theory. We're here after a 4-day trial, testimony from 18 witnesses. There were roughly 78 exhibits with hundreds and hundreds of pages comprising them. The documents were reviewed during testimony. They were addressed with questions propounded by both attorneys with answers from both parties. The evidence was evaluated by the jury and the court, and we come out with the verdict as it is. 7 hours of deliberation it took, over 2 days for a unanimous verdict to be entered.
One of the primary arguments that your colleague on the other side of the podium advanced, sort of concerns me, and that is the nature of the argument, how you framed your theory and the analogy to the baby. And, there aren't very many cases where we would provide relief on appeal when a lawyer didn't object at trial. Mm-hmm. But why isn't this just the repeated language, the baby, the dismemberment, the killing, and in the context of the facts of this particular case? I mean, why doesn't that present a situation where we as an appellate court should be concerned to the extent that a new trial is warranted?
Reasonable question under the circumstances based on his arguments. However, in
this case, based on reading the transcript, I don't understand necessarily why that was your approach. I understand people have different approaches, but why wouldn't this be a case under all the circumstances where a new trial would be warranted because the damages are so excessive that they could only have been awarded based on prejudice?
Well, I don't feel the damages are excessive, but with regard to the arguments, Laughlin's dream was his baby. Laughlin's dream. Started a company, you dream about how it's going to grow and develop into a successful business. He put his life into that company. He capitalized it by draining his retirement. He capitalized it by trading in trucks that he or a truck that he owned in order to purchase other trucks for the company. Mortgaged his home, lost his home as a result of the seizure and Mr. Cerussi's actions. He invested his whole life into the development of a company, which was his dream. Effectively, much like how a parent would put your dreams into what your baby is going to grow up to be. Are they going to grow up to be successful? Are they going to grow up to be homeless? God forbid anybody dream that. But it's an investment in an item, into something. And Mr. Cerussi's actions during the course of their business relationship had certain influences on how the dream of Laughlin was shattered.
Right, and you've explained it today in a way that's very different than how you argued it to the jury. And, you know, given, again, the religious context and longstanding concerns about the language you used, I mean, why isn't that something that should concern this court?
Well, frankly, I've never heard of blood libel before I saw the brief. That was totally a shock to me, that the references were made to Holocaust references and things like that. Regardless of who the others...
But agree statements along those lines are inappropriate.
Well, no, not really. The statements were made in the context of showing how a business partner came in and just totally destroyed a man's dreams. They were not inappropriate in the context that it was an illustration that everyone can relate to of how your child is growing, it's starting to get business, it's starting to stumble forward as a lot of businesses do. Not many of them get off the ground in our multi-million dollar industries like Apple Computers. They stumble forward a little bit. They grow. They find other people to interact with. That was the perspective of the opening statement and the closing argument, for that matter. How the business was stumbling along. It was starting to grow. They were gaining contracts. They had for instance, the Carolyn Kleinke contract, which was a big part of Mr. Cerussi's arguments during the trial, that he was responsible for it. But Ms. Kleinke testified to the fact that he had no role in it. She had made up her mind around to use LB Spray Foam as the contractor around the time that Cerussi and Laughlin met, unbeknownst to her knowledge. Mr. Laughlin was the impetus behind that contract. The jury heard the testimony from each of the parties about how the business failed, the sealed envelope business failed. They heard testimony from each of the parties about how one perceived that he was buying half an interest, and Mr. Laughlin's testimony that adamantly denied that he was selling or even inkled into selling any of his business in LB Spray Foam.
I
was just going to mention, that's just a credibility determination. The jury heard that, mm-hmm. heard your version, his version. Two witnesses may have offered an attempt at corroboration, but the jury ultimately decides, correct?
Yes, yep. And Your Honor, you hit it right on the head with the discussion about the exhibits, Exhibit 236, in transcript pages 259 to 262, where there was substantial discussion about respondents' exhibits in the trial. And during those pages, there was clear references that these exhibits were being accepted as admissible evidence. They were admitted into evidence.
So whether that should have happened or not, that is what happened. They were admitted.
Yeah, and at that point, I was fully aware that all of the exhibits that appellants had presented at trial were also being admitted. Mr. Cerussi's damage chart, which is Exhibit 36 from the trial, had $1.8 million in claim damages. I took it at that point where I knew that I either had to prove up my damages or and with specificity in questioning my witnesses, or I needed to risk what happened with Mr. Cerussi not going line by line through his damage chart to the extent that we did.
Help me understand, speaking of the damages, help me understand the evidentiary support for the jury's verdict of almost $450,000 for unjust enrichment.
Well, I can't get into the jury's mind to tell how they came up with their computations. Appellant seems to have seized on the particular item of all the deposits into Mr. Cerussi's bank accounts.
Well, that's a big, according to Exhibit 236, that's $250,000?
It's big potatoes.
More than that, actually. I'm just looking at one line.
Yeah, I think it was close to 270, maybe. With respect to that, during discovery, Mr. Cerussi was asked and compelled to provide information regarding his deposits into his account. He did not provide them. He refused to provide them. We came to trial. He didn't have any evidence to refute it. Therefore,
there wasn't any testimony about money for the SBA loan that didn't come in?
Not a thing, not a peep. Not until post-trial. And for all we know, it could have been an SBA loan secured for sealed envelope or for LB Spray Foam if he was out there representing himself as an owner of LB Spray Foam. We have no idea. He did get a contractor's license after he seized all the equipment from Mr. Laughlin. He opened a construction company. There are deposits into the bank accounts from his construction company that he was running, significant deposits into it. The jury would have to look through everything, and this was a jury that was fairly astute as far as financial skills and understanding. There were bookkeepers, there were accountants, there were small business people, there were IT professionals. It was a jury that could smell a rat and figure out what's happening and trace the money and made a decision based on what they saw in the jury room with the exhibits. One key comment that Mr. Cerussi had during direct examination that I probably should have pointed out in the brief, but when I was reading through it, I missed it. It was a question in direct examination by Mr. Hadler, his trial counsel. It shows on page 203 of the transcript, lines 16 to 18. Mr. Hadler asked him, "What would you do with the property you're holding that belongs to Mr. Laughlin if you received that money?" And that money being a reference to a judgment in the amount of $108,000 or whatever he was claiming at the time. Answer: "I would bring it back since we have no deal anymore." His testimony during trial on cross-examination was that he had the truck stripped on June 29th and 30th, right after he seized it on the 17th. He says he instantly sold the equipment out of the spray foam truck, $100,000 roughly worth of spray foam equipment, new, which was less than a year old. He says he sold it to an unknown person that he contacted off of Facebook for an unknown amount. He couldn't tell us what the amount was. He didn't know who the person was, and he didn't know what happened to the money, except he spent it. Well, he's out running another construction company with several hundred thousand dollars worth of Mr. Laughlin's property, and he can't account for what happened to it. The jury would have a reasonable basis to think that, hey, he's got all this stuff yet. He's taken it. He's using it for his own gains. it makes sense for supporting an award of damages like the jury came up with. If the panel has any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
It appears not.
Once again, we reiterate that the trial court's decision and the jury's verdict should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And the first Mr. Hansen will have the last word.
Too many Scandinavians practicing for court.
Different spellings, though. That always helps.
A point that I'd like to make, going back to the argument that we just heard. There was a discussion about an SBA loan, okay? Question is, what was appropriate to award under unjust enrichment? Well, an SBA loan has to be repaid. That's not net money that Tal Cerussi ended up with. It's not money that is appropriate to say he's been unjustly enriched by this money. That,
that testimony didn't get to the jury.
You
can't impute that knowledge to the jury. You got to present it somehow, right?
Right, certainly. But, I mean, it is in his bank records as an SBA loan. That's what it says. Similarly, the argument was just made, well, he had this equipment and he might have gone and done other jobs. We don't recover that under unjust enrichment. The point is...
And the jury, the court instructed the jury on that point, right?
Right. And respectfully, the jury got it wrong. That's really the only way you get to the result that we've got here, okay? And then it comes back to what's the role of the judge, okay? And that's why we have remitter. And, there's a quote here that I wanted to give you. Remitter requires that the district court consider all of the evidence and determine whether the verdict is within the bounds of the highest sustainable award under the evidence. That's the job on a remitter. District court didn't do that. Putting aside the deeply offensive comments, you look at this, at these numbers that are awarded here, and it's just not sustainable on the record and under the law. And it's the court's job to say, when the jury gets it wrong, to step in and fix it, and that didn't happen.
What would an appropriate remitter award be? What should the district court have done?
I think that $70,000 number is certainly something that I would have said you don't have a sustainable appeal on. But at this point, I don't think that's this court's job. I think that it needs to be sent back, and I think that it
new
needs
trial or direct the district court to remit the verdict or what?
I believe that basically this trial went so badly off the rails that the answer is it has to be a new trial. I believe that that's the appropriate outcome here. I do not think that you can separate the deeply prejudicial comments from the wildly unbased jury award, that those two things are intimately connected. And I go back to the language in Hake where it talks about whether or not the jury award is so far out of bounds as to be, the only thing it could have been was the result of prejudice. Well, that's this.
But in that case, wasn't that affirmed by the Supreme Court?
Hake is, yes. And
the excessive award or the award was affirmed in that case.
Right. And the comment in that case was a reference to the Edmund Fitzgerald. It wasn't a religious slur. I think one of the things that this case presents to this court is, if not this, then what? Is so far out of bounds as to require the district court, objection or no, to step in and say, nope, we're not going to have that as part of the decision-making of the jury. And I would submit that this is that case.
Doesn't the failure to object, though, prevent the giving of a corrective instruction? And that's part of the problem, is that when there's a failure to object, then the district court can't correct it.
That's true, okay? I would respectfully submit to you that if our fact scenario was that they objected by the time they got to closing and we'd had all the references to the killing and dismemberment of the baby, that it would have been at the point where a corrective instruction was no longer good enough. And Haik talks about that, where it specifically says, if it's too far past this line, the court has an obligation to intervene, and part of that analysis is, would a corrective instruction fix it? And I certainly, by the time we get to the end of this case, if the district court had said, you know, by the way, that's problematic and you need to disregard it, I would submit that that's not good enough, that this is so offensive, so over the line, and so prejudicial that you couldn't fix it with a corrective instruction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your appearance today. The matters are submitted.